Every year we do something a little special for Halloween. I don't think this year should be any different. Welcome to Helpful Snowman Potoween. Welcome, everybody. Welcome to Helpful Snowman Potoween. I am Pete. I am making chili on the stove, and I'm doing a podcast while my laundry dries. This is the man that I've become. Some great political commercials whenever you're looking on YouTube anymore. Good God. It turns out every politician is a horrible liar, according to another guy. I like how their credentials are basically like, "Hi, I'm Cory Gardner. Here's why you should vote for me." And then they just tell you everything awful about some other guy. And they don't say one thing about, they don't even bother anymore to be like, "And I disagree with that." They just tell you all this horrible shit. For all I know, they're completely on the same page with everything. I went to a Whole Foods today. This is spooky. I just wanted to quickly say I went to a Whole Foods, and I am not good at Whole Foods. I bought some kale chips that I thought would be good, and they weren't. I brought some kind of dried broccoli snack that I thought would be good. It was not. This is in response to the pure number of fries I've had in the last couple days. I had some fries and a huge burger. Last night, went to see, one of my personal heroes, Chuck Palahniuk, do a reading. It happened in a church, which was fantastic because he told two stories. One about basically genital warts that become a huge monster, like a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, except Mr. Hyde is made out of weird mutated genital warts. And another story about people who are having sex at a drive-in and through various events basically start each other on fire. You know, pubes first, fire happens. Overall, a very delightful time. This is the thing, you guys. If you've never been to a reading, if you're like, "I don't know, author reading, that sounds dumb," you're right. But his readings are very fun, and here's why. At this particular reading, what happened is you get this beach ball, you blow it up, and then it's got this separate hole. It's got kind of an outer beach ball and then an inner beach ball, and it's got this butthole that you put glow sticks into. So then you've got these light-up balls sort of like at the roller rink would hang from the ceiling. Everyone's got these. You write your name on it, and then at some different points during the night, they turn off all the lights. Everyone throws their beach balls into the center, and it's this glowing mass of flying balls around, and then they pick out some, and you win a prize. Or, you know, they were whipping huge bags of candy all through this church, you know, hitting the pews, and it's like, bam, when it hits. I mean, this is a fun time, is what I'm getting at. It's not like you just go and listen to a guy read, and it's boring. It's very fun. Every time. Oh, there were a couple good weirdos, as there are for every reading. This is another good game to play at a reading, especially if you go to one and you find yourself bored. This is a good thing to do if you find yourself bored anywhere. This is kind of my helpful snowman tip of the day. There are two games that I like to play if I get bored and I'm in a public place. Number one, pick a new friend. So you have to kind of just see who's in your like immediate area that you can see and pick one that you would go on like a friend date with. You could hang out with, whatever. The other is, you know, watch out for the weirdo. There was a guy sitting right behind us who laughed extremely loud at different things. And also, he seemed to be on like a 10-second delay. I'm like 90% sure he was on shrooms or something. Because he was on a good 10-second delay. People would laugh, and everyone would kind of stop laughing, and then he would burst out laughing. There's also a sort of different breed of weirdo. He, you know, Chuck Palahniuk takes questions. And during the Q&A period, this woman in the very back was like yelling for him to let her ask a question. So, you know, he's like, yeah, you in the back. And she's like, what kind of things do you do when you're not writing? Do you have any other sort of artistic pursuits like painting or drawing or making things? And she like went on and on suggesting, I guess, things. And it was really annoying because you're just like, okay, ask the question and then shut up and listen to the answer. So then he kind of answers and he's saying how he does, he collects rocks, different sort of rocks from places, and then he actually puts them into jewelry that he gives to fans. And so he's kind of talking about this whole story because he's saying how, you know, it's got something to do with his mom and as he's traveled and da-da-da-da. And, you know, it's funny because you're like, he's Chuck Palahniuk and he's just read us this whole story. I mean, I think every story, you know, both of his stories he talked about were about butt sex. And then he was telling us this story about a guy who, you know, got AIDS and da 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 and was worried he gave it to his bulldog, but he didn't. Not, and then, you know, the guy is saying this to a therapist and realized the therapist thinks he's fucking the dog, but he was not fucking the dog. And then he's, you know, saying how he's like, I'm sort of just an amateur geologist. So he's kind of telling this little story about it. And that's what's fun, too, is Q&A. You know, usually people don't ask questions, and then he's just like, you know, where'd you get your inspiration? And then he's like, you know, from stuff. He'll tell a whole little story, and that makes it a lot more fun. It's like an event, right? So this lady asks the question. He's answering the question, and he's kind of like wrapping it up, getting to the end of the story. And she just is like yelling from the back. She's like, okay, thank you. That's enough. Thank you. Like stopping him from answering the rest of the question, I guess. I don't know why she had decided like, I've heard enough. I'm done. So those are the good weirdos. I recommend seeing Chuck Palahniuk in your city. Even if you're not a huge fan of his, it's a fun event. You know, like last year, I did the Santa Rampage thing, which I think I'm going to replicate this year. And the reason I did that was because I decided I needed to do more things. It's been about a year since I went to Tom Spanbauer workshop in Portland. And when I came back, I decided that I wanted to have like a life. And I wanted to do more things. And I tried to plan some event for like one weekend every month. Because I thought, even if it's not a big event, even if it's just something, I want to do stuff. Like, I want to have things happen. So, in that spirit, if you decide you want to do that, I recommend looking him up, seeing if he's coming to your city soon. Quick announcement before we get on to Potoween. As of this moment, I have four titles on Amazon's Kindle store. I have the poetry collection, Barehanded. I have a book that's called Origins. Now, this is interesting. This is a collection of blogs that I wrote on MySpace. So MySpace kind of died, but at some point, I went back to my MySpace page. I could not log in and export the blog, so I had to copy and paste this entire blog. And I did that. And it was huge and long and whatever. And then I, over, I guess, the last decade, have cut it down. And so now it's like, I don't know, 75 or so blog entries from that time, such as my chocolate credit card, the time I punched a koala, all, you know, crazy shit. I guess when I say blog, I don't know if I mean blog. I mean, I think when I say blog, people imagine it's me talking about my real life, which it mostly isn't. I mean, there's little bits and pieces here that are based on real life, usually how pathetic my real life is at this time, and the rest is just kind of a crazy free-for-all. So I recommend that. There's an ebook called The First to Me. That's a few short stories that I wrote. They've actually been up on the website, but now they are in convenient Kindle ebook form. So if you'd like to read those, please do. I wrote some little introductions to each one as well, because I thought that'd be fun. And finally, I put up the essay I wrote last year for the Spanbauer workshop, actually, in its finished form, which is called Tough Shoot. And it's about my grandma's death and this sort of dinner we had afterwards. And that one's rather short. However, these are all priced at $1. And I went off on this whole thing on my unhelpfulsnowman.com about it. But basically, you should just know that if I sell an ebook, I make 35 cents. And so far, I think I've made, well, I know I've made less than $20 total for these efforts. And for the, you know, that includes the podcasting, the website, all this stuff, I have made less than $20. And I don't mean that in a net profit. I mean, that's the gross profits. Subtract everything else. I mean, just to keep, if I didn't do anything to the website for the next year, other than keep it afloat, it costs about $75. You know, so that, there you go. That, if that gives you any sort of idea. So if you want to buy something, if you want to send some money my way, or if you want to read one of these books, that's where you go. The links are up on my website, and also just, you know, search my name in Amazon, you'll find them. Okay? Or find them on Goodreads. If you don't want to buy them, add them to your Goodreads to read list. That puts it out there a little more. Also, if you do buy them, please write a review. I don't even care if it's a good review. Well, that's not true. I would prefer you wrote a good review, but just do reviews. None of these books have enough reviews for Amazon to actually put reviews, and that makes them look extremely illegitimate, which they are, but nevertheless. So Potoween. This year, what I decided to do for Potoween, well, first I decided to queue up a spooky fireplace haunted house ambience with rain. And what I decided to do this year is a little different. Rather than answer Halloween questions, because I feel like I've done that quite a bit in the past, I thought what I would do is kind of see if I couldn't explore the creepier side of Wikipedia. Look at the creepiest stuff that's on there. So I found some creepy articles, or at least a listing of creepy articles, I should say, and thought we should just go through them and see the deep, dark corners of Wikipedia. The first entry, let's see, there are some, now some of these are, you know, I can see what the entries are called, but not what they're about. So for example, Roanoke Colony. That doesn't really, I understand this is creepy, like this is some kind of colonization thing where a bunch of people disappeared or some shit. I don't really care about that. I gotta believe, in the colony days, weren't people just like fucking disappearing all over the place? I mean, seriously, come on. I feel like a colony would disappear like every 3 days. I mean, one rhino could wipe out a village, right? Or just a crazy grizzly bear could just knock everyone's houses over and kill them. Give me a break. However, a little way down the list, we have concrete-encased high school girl murder case. The murder of Junko Furuta. I wish I could make the thunder go right then. Junko was a 16-year-old Japanese high school student who was abducted, tortured, raped, and murdered in the late 1980s. Her murder case was named the Concrete Encased High School Girl Murder Case. Very catchy. due to the state of her discovered body in a concrete drum filled with over 50 gallons of cement. So, basically, the killers hid her corpse in a 55-gallon drum filled with concrete. The perpetrators disposed of the drum in a tract of reclaimed land in Tokyo. When the victim's mother was informed of what happened, she fainted and had to be taken for psychiatric treatment. Okay. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. This seems a little... It's her corpse was put in cement. I mean, that's fucked up. Don't get me wrong. But if you were alive, put in the drum of cement, now we're talking. That's a scary story. But, I don't know. And also, where are, like, high school kids getting a drum? That's what I want to know. I want to know, like, if I had to get a drum right now, if I had to make a bum fire or encase a girl in cement, I don't know if I could. I don't know if I could get my hands on a drum. This is another game I like to play. Usually I start it with steroids. I say, do you think you could get your hands on steroids in 24 hours? Like, if you really wanted to, or if your life depended on it, let's say, could you in 24 hours get your hands on this? And this always excludes, like, an Amazon Prime. That's why steroids are a great choice, because you can't just buy fucking steroids on Amazon Prime. People are really confident in their ability to get steroids. And I bet they're overconfident in their ability to get a drum as well. Let's move on. Should we try thalidomide? What is that going to be? I don't know if I trust this listing of creepy articles. It's a drug prescribed as a sedative or a hypnotic. That's dumb. Bunny Man. This better not be from the motion picture Donnie Darko, otherwise I'm going to be very upset. Ooh. The Bunny Man is an urban legend that probably originated from two incidents in Fairfax County, Virginia in 1970, but has been spread throughout the Washington, D.C. area. There are many variations to the legend, but most involve a man wearing a rabbit costume who attacks people with an axe. That's what I'm fucking talking about. That is Halloween. Story of variations include the origin of the Bunny Man, names, motives, weapons, victims, description of the bunny suit or lack thereof, and the possible death of the Bunny Man. In some accounts, the Bunny Man's ghost or aging specter is said to come out of his place of death each year on Halloween to commemorate his death. In some accounts, victims' bodies are mutilated. Let's see. Fairfax County Public Library historian archivist Brian A. Conley conducted extensive research on the Bunny Man legend. He's located two incidents of a man in a rabbit costume threatening people with an axe. The vandalism reports occurred a week apart in 1970 in Burke, Virginia. I don't understand how this is a vandalism report. A man in a bunny costume running with... Yeah, you vandalized my sense of safety and sanity. The first incident was reported the evening of October 19, 1970, by U.S. Air Force Academy cadet Bob Bennett and his fiancée, who were visiting relatives on Guinea Road in Burke. Around midnight, while returning from a football game, they parked their car in a field on Guinea Road to talk. Yeah, right. As they sat in the front seat with the car running, they noticed something moving outside the rear window. Moments later, the front passenger window was smashed and there was a white-clad figure standing near the broken window. Bennett turned the car around while the man screamed at them about trespassing, including, "You're on private property and I have your tag number." As they drove down the road, they discovered a hatchet on the car floor. When the police asked for a description of the man, Bob insisted he was wearing a white suit with long bunny ears, but his fiancée remembered something white and pointed like a Ku Klux Klan hood. They both remembered seeing his face clearly, but in the darkness they could not determine his race. The police returned the hatchet to Bennett after examination. Bennett was okay, blah, blah, blah. The second report sighting occurred on the evening of October 29th, 1970, when construction security guard Paul Phillips approached a man standing on the porch of an unfinished home. Phillips said the man was wearing a gray, black, and white bunny suit and was about 20 years old, 5'8", and weighed about 175. The man began chopping at a porch post with a long-handled axe, saying, "All you people trespass around here. If you don't get out of here, I'm going to bust you on the head. Cases were closed for lack of evidence. More than 50 people contacted the police, claiming to have seen the Bunny Man. Several newspapers reported on the incident of the Bunny Man eating a man's runaway cat, including the following articles from the Washington Post. And in 1973, University of Maryland student Patricia Johnson submitted a research paper that chronicled precisely 54 variations of these two events. This is pretty great. So one version of the story states that in 1904, an asylum prison in Clifton, Virginia was shut down by successful petition of the growing population of residents in Fairfax County. During the transfer of inmates to a new facility, the transport carrying the inmates crashed. Some prisoners escaped or were found dead. A search party found all but one. During this time, locals allegedly began to find hundreds of cleanly skinned, half-eaten carcasses of rabbits hanging from the trees in surrounding areas. Oh, see, now this is getting good. When I hear bunny suit, I'm thinking, like, Easter bunny suit. But this is much better. Police located the remains of Marcus Walster, left in a similar fashion to the rabbit carcasses hanging in a nearby tree or under a bridge overpass, known locally as the Bunny Man Bridge. Officials named the last missing inmate, Douglas J. Griffin, as their suspect and call him the Bunny Man. In this version, officials finally managed to locate Griffin, but during their attempt to apprehend him at the overpass, he nearly escaped before being hit by an oncoming train where the original transport crashed. They say after the train passed, police said they had heard laughter coming from the site. It is eventually revealed that Griffin was institutionalized for killing his family and children on Easter Sunday. That is some Batman villain shit right there. For years after the Bunny Man's death, in the time approaching Halloween, carcasses are said to be found hanging from the overpass and surrounding areas. A figure is reportedly seen by passersby making their way through the one-lane bridge tunnel. That's excellent. Yeah, there's pictures of a creepy bridge. This is good. I like this. That one worked out. Bunny Man. That is a good, scary costume. I mean, Donnie Darko kind of ruined it, right? Now you can't be some creepy bunny. But there's probably a good, you know, I think there's going to be a good killer maybe in a banana outfit. Banana Man. Did you guys know that bananas actually do become slippery when you step on them? I think I talked about this in a podcast, but this would have been like fucking 5 years ago. I was in Times Square, of all places, walking. Stepped in something, slipped all over the fucking place. I thought maybe it was dog shit. It was a fucking banana peel, like goddamn Mario Kart. Let's see what else we got. Oh, excuse me. Let's see, we've got... this is just a creek that's really gross because it's got blood and entrails in it. That's boring. Original Spanish kitchen. That doesn't sound that scary. It was a popular eating spot until September 1961. I don't know. This doesn't sound very exciting. Original Spanish kitchen. That just sounds like a terrible... That's a kitchen nightmare. I think they've confused a kitchen nightmare with like a Halloween nightmare. The Pope Lick Monster. Now, Pope Lick, in case, you know, I know my plosive P's are a little much sometimes here. That's the Pope as in the guy who is, you know, what's his name? Benedict Pope Derbatch. Lick, as in lick with your tongue. And monster, as in the Munsters, but with an O. The Pope Lick Monster is a legendary part man, part goat, and part sheep creature reported to live beneath a Norfolk Southern Railway trestle over Floyd's Fork Creek in Fisherville area of Louisville, Kentucky. Already I'm happy because it's part man, part goat, part sheep. Three parts of a thing. How that's possible, we'll find out. In most accounts, the Popelick Monster, named after the Popelick Creek below the Popelick train trestle. I like how already they're like, well, it's called the Popelick Monster. It's not because he's licking the Pope. It's because he's named for a creek that's named for licking the Pope. Well, that makes a lot more sense. Naming a monster that is crazy, but naming a creek, well, let's go down to Popelick Creek. That sounds great. He appears as a human-goat hybrid with a grotesquely deformed body of a man. Yeah, no shit. It has powerful fur-covered goat legs, an alabaster-skinned face with an aquiline nose and wide-set eyes. Short, sharp horns. I'm talking like I'm from Louisville. Short, sharp horns protrude from the forehead, nestled in long, greasy hair that match the color of the fur on the legs. Numerous urban legends exist about the creature's origins and the method it employs to acclaim its victims. According to some accounts, the creature uses either hypnosis or voice mimicry to lure trespassers onto the trestle to meet their death before an oncoming train. That's a good one. I like that. It's like that troll on the bridge with the goat thing. Other stories claim the monster jumps down from the trestle onto the roofs of cars passing beneath it. Yet other legends tell that it attacks its victims with a blood-stained axe. It has also been said that the very sight of the creature is so unsettling that those who see it while walking across the high trestle are driven to leap off. Other legends explain the creature's origins, including that it is a human-goat hybrid and that it was a circus freak who vowed revenge after being mistreated. In one version, the creature escaped after a train derailed on the trestle. Another version, commonly told by locals of the area, claims that the monster is really the twisted, reincarnated form of a farmer who sacrificed goats in exchange for satanic powers. The legends have turned the area into a site for legend tripping. There have been a number of deaths and accidents at the trestle since its construction, despite the presence of an 8-foot fence to keep thrill seekers out. There are misconceptions that indicate this train trestle is abandoned and no longer used. This is false. Trains go over this bridge many times on a daily basis, so it is easy for someone to get caught atop the bridge while an oncoming train barrels down on them. Authorities urge citizens not to attempt thrill-seeking in this area due to the very real risk of death by train. Oh, that's awesome. So what we have going on here is it sounds like you've got this monster. People go looking for this monster on this quote-unquote abandoned train zone. And then they find, oh, fuck, well, there's actually a train here and now I'm going to just get murdered by a train. I like this. This is like a urban legend that works, you know, because the monster is sort of killing people, even though it's not. I mean, maybe it is, maybe it's not, but the people are sure as hell dying. Well, I would be laying down on my job if I did not click on Boy Scout Lane. That's Boy Scout as in the last Boy Scout. Boy Scout Lane, sometimes written Boy Scout, one word, Lane, is an isolated road located in Stevens Point, Wisconsin. A number of ghost stories and urban legends have become associated with the road, including the fictional deaths of a troop of Boy Scouts. Ah, man. The area has been the subject of several paranormal investigations and has been a haunt for youths hoping to experience paranormal events. The land surrounding Boy Scout Lane is now privately owned and it is off limits to the general public. Oh, that sucks. Who the fuck buys the land around Boy Scout Lane? And how do you not rename it? Wouldn't you rename it and just be like, yeah, we're gonna change the name of this to, I don't know, Tree Lane? Penny Lane? Anything other than Boy Scout Lane. According to a local urban legend, the road is named for a troop of Boy Scouts who were killed while on a camping trip in the 1950s or 60s. In some variations, the murderer is the troop's scoutmaster. In others, it is their bus driver. In other versions of the legend, a small group of scouts leave their camp during the night and accidentally drop their lantern, resulting in a forest fire that kills the entire troop. Other variations of the story exist, including one in which the scouts are killed after their bus crashes or accidentally catches fire. There's also a version in which the scouts vanish without explanation and are never found. In some versions of the legend, two Boy Scouts escaped the fate of the rest of the troop and tried to find help, only to become lost in the woods where they die of starvation and/or exposure. In most variations of the legend, it is said that the dead scouts haunt the forest where they died and can be heard hiking through the undergrowth, or their lights can be seen at night as they seek help of their fellow scouts. Stories circulated in haunted travel guides include visitors reporting a strong sense of foreboding or being watched. Ghostly buses or figures and childlike handprints on cars stopped in or driven through the area. That's awesome. You know, when I was in Boy Scouts, we went to Ben Delator Scout Ranch, and we did like a week-long camp. And this guy told this story, like this adult man told this story, and it's called, like, Stumpy. It's called Stumpy. And basically, it was a ghost story about this guy who was in the woods, and there was a forest fire, and a tree falls on him. And so he has to cut, you know, a tree falls on him, and I don't know if he already didn't have legs or what happened, but he has to cut off his hands and feet, basically, or his legs below the knee and his hands at the elbow or something. And then because he now doesn't have forearms and lower legs, he becomes this sort of, you know, monster of the woods and just attacks and kills people. And, you know, he learns to live with his stumps, and he's more adept at getting around through the woods on his stumps than he ever was with hands and feet. Now, that is a very weird story, isn't it? Like a ghost story. Stumpy haunting the wood, and his name is Stumpy. So that's nice. I remember being in my tent and being like, oh, shit. I hope Stumpy's not real, and if he was, I hope he knows that I, you know, respect him for overcoming his handicap. I'm not like these other assholes laughing at him. I'm like, hey, you know, not cool. Not cool, guys. Everybody just leave it alone. Okay? Let's find another creepy article, shall we? Let's see. Ooh, head transplant. That sounds pretty good to me. A head transplant is a surgical operation that involves the grafting of one organism's heads onto the body of another. No shit. I just want to keep going. Since the technology required to reattach a severed spinal cord has not been developed, the subject of a head transplant would be quadriplegic unless proper therapies were developed. This technique has been proposed as possibly useful for people who are already quadriplegic and who are also suffering from widespread organ failures, which would otherwise require several distinct and difficult transplant surgeries. It may also be useful for people who'd rather be quadriplegic than dead. The consensus on the ethics of such a procedure is negative. Well, that makes a lot of sense, I guess. Whoa. Yeah, that's an interesting question. Like, if I found out my body's riddled with cancer, but my head is safe. And they're like, well, we can transplant your head, but you will be quadriplegic. Now, maybe in the next 10 years, we'll discover a way to fix that. But maybe not. I mean, you'd be kind of fucked. Although you'd be less fucked than before. So what this seems to be indicating to me, however, is that it is possible to give someone a complete head transplant. In other words, it is theoretically possible that they could take my head and put it on a body. And granted, I wouldn't be able to move that body around, but I would still be alive. This is Futurama head in a jar, basically, except your head is still attached to a body. On May 21st, 1908, Charles Guthrie succeeded in grafting one dog's head onto the side of another's neck, creating the world's first man-made two-headed dog. Holy shit, there's a picture of it. The arteries were grafted together such that the blood of the intact dog flowed through the head of the decapitated dog and then back into the intact dog's neck, where it proceeded to the brain and back into circulation. Guthrie's book Blood Vessel Surgery and Its Applications includes a photograph of the historic creature. Were it not for the caption, the photo would seem to be of some rare form of marsupial dog, with a large baby's head protruding from the pouch on its mother's fur. The transplanted head was sewn on at the base of the neck upside down so that the two dogs are chin to chin, giving an impression of intimacy despite what must have been at the very least a strained coexistence. Too much time, 20 minutes, had elapsed between the beheading and the moment the circulation was restored for the dog head and brain to regain much function. Guthrie recorded a series of primitive movements and basic reflexes, similar to what Laborde and Hayem observed: pupil contractions, nostril twitchings, boiling movements of the tongue. Holy fuck. The first dog heads to enjoy, if that word can be used, full cerebral function were those of transplantation whiz Vladimir Demikov in the Soviet Union in the 50s. Demikov minimized the time that the severed donor head was without oxygen by using blood vessel sewing machines. He transplanted 20 puppy heads, actually heads, head, shoulder, lungs, and forelimbs units with an esophagus that emptied untidily onto the outside of the dog, onto fully grown dogs to see what they would do and how long they would last, usually from 2 to 6 days, but in one case as long as 29 days. In his book, Experimental Transplantation of Vital Organs, Demikov included photographs of and lab notes from Experiment Number 2 on February 24, 1954. The transplantation of a one-month-old puppy's head and forelimbs to the neck of what appears to be a German shepherd. The notes portray a lively, puppy-like, if not altogether joyous existence on the part of the head. 0900, the donor's head eagerly drank water or milk and tugged as if trying to separate itself from the recipient's body. 2230, when the recipient was put to bed, the transplanted head bit the finger of a member of the staff until it bled. February 26, 1800, the donor's head bit the recipient behind the ear so that the latter yelped and shook its head. Demikov's transplant subjects were typically done in by immune reactions. In 1959, China announced they had succeeded in transplanting the head of one dog to the body of another twice. Holy fuck! That's pretty crazy. Oh, on March 4th, 1970, a group of scientists from Case Western Reserve University School of Medicine in Cleveland, Ohio, led by Robert J. White, a neurosurgeon and professor of neurological surgery who was inspired by the work of Vladimir Demikov, performed a highly controversial operation to transplant the head of one monkey onto another's body. The procedure was a success to some extent, with the animal being able to smell, taste, hear, and see the world around it. The operation involved cauterizing arteries and veins carefully while the head was being severed to prevent hypovolemia. Because the nerves were left entirely intact, connecting the brain to a blood supply kept it chemically alive. The animal survived for some time after the operation, even at times attempting to bite some of the staff. In 2001, Dr. White successfully repeated the operation on a monkey. He later wrote, "What has been accomplished in the animal model, prolonged hypothermic preservation and cephalic transplantation, is fully accomplishable in the human sphere. Whether such dramatic procedures will ever be justified in the human area must wait not only upon the continued advance of medical science, but more appropriately the moral and social justification of such procedural undertakings. What has always been the stuff of science fiction, the Frankenstein legend in which the entire human being is constructed by sewing various parts together, will become a clinical reality in the early 21st century. Brain transplantation, at least initially, will really be head transplantation, or body transplantation, depending on your perspective. With the significant improvements in surgical techniques and post-operative management since then, it is now possible to consider adapting the head transplant technique to humans." In 2002, other head transplants were conducted in Japan in rats. However, these head transplants involved grafting one rat's head onto the body of another rat that has kept its head. Thus, the rat ended up with two heads. The scientists said the key to a successful head transplant was to use low temperatures. Well, I've always said that. A human head transplant would most likely require cooling off the brain to the point where all neural activity stops. This is to prevent neurons from dying while the brain is being transplanted. Ethical considerations have thus far prevented any reported attempts by surgeons to transplant a human being's head. That's crazy. Creating a headless body is a whole... Wow. interesting question. Like, would you be interested in, you know, would you consider having your head transplanted onto a paralyzed body? I guess I could still do this, right? I would be paralyzed below the neck. I could still do podcasts if I just had someone to do the rest of this shit for me. So that would be a plus. That's something. Okay. Let's move on to the next. Let's find something else that sounds good. Quantum immortality sounds boring. Mellified man, is that some kind of monster, I hope? Oh boy, okay. Mellified man, or human mummy confection, was a legendary medicinal substance created by steeping a human cadaver in honey. The concoction is mentioned only in Chinese sources, most significantly something of the 16th century Chinese pharmacologist Li Xinzhen. Relying on a second-hand account, Li reports a story that some elderly men in Arabia, nearing the end of their lives, would submit themselves to a process of mummification in honey to create a healing confection. Wow. After a century or so, the donor would stop eating any food other than honey, going as far as to bathe in the substance. Shortly, his feces, and even his sweat, according to legend, would consist of honey. When this diet finally proved fatal, the donor's body would be placed in a stone coffin filled with honey. After a century or so, the contents would have turned into a sort of confection, reputedly capable of healing broken limbs and other ailments. The confection would then be carefully sold in street markets as a hard-to-find item with a hefty price. That's pretty awesome. So let me ask this question then. Like, let's say you broke your leg. Now, if you've never broken a limb, it sucks. I mean, there's like, you know, the shitty part of having the broken limb and all that and the pain. But the real thing, I think, the real weird issue with the whole thing is like, now you've got this cast, your entire life is much more difficult. And by the way, I mean, I'm glad that when I had my broken limb, it was like, you know, I was in middle school. So who cares, right? But it smells. It smells so bad. Just imagine if you had to wear a sock on your foot for 6 weeks. 6 weeks, no changing the sock. How good do you think that would smell? I'm sure you've noticed that we tend to change socks. So here's the question. You break a leg. It's going to be 6 weeks in the cast, wheelchair, crutch, whatever. But you could eat this mellified man and it would heal instantly. Strong as ever, good as new. None of these problems. Now, mellified man is not something that, you know, there's not really a market for it, right? I don't know. Would you eat it? I think I might. Be like, fuck it, I'll try it. See what happens. I doubt it's going to be very delicious. I don't think someone can just eat. You know, this is kind of like a way more morbid and crazy version of like, if you eat a bunch of pineapple, then your semen will taste good and girls will give you a blowjob. That doesn't work. If anyone needs proof of that, try this. Drink a bunch of pineapple juice and then drink your own pee. See how much it might taste a little different, but is it going to taste not like pee? I think it's still going to taste like pee, my friends. I have a strong feeling you will still be drinking a very urine-like substance when you go to drink that nice glass of pee. I'm having a hard time telling what's the sound in my headphones and what the real sounds are. Scary, right? Anyway, I don't know. I think I would probably go for it, but that's because I'm crazy. I am just a little too crazy. Let's see. The Star Child Skull. The Star Child Skull is an abnormal human skull allegedly found in Mexico that was claimed to be the product of extraterrestrial human breeding or genetic mutilation. Mitochondrial DNA recovered from the skull has established it as human. Neurologist Stephen Novella believes it to be the skull of a child who died as a result of congenital hydrocephalus. Ooh, God. There's a nice picture of hydrocephalus. Young children with hydrocephalus typically have an abnormally large head, as fluid pressure causes the individual skull bones to bulge outward. It is pretty alien-ish looking. Star Child Skull. That's awful. Let's see. What else looks really good? Penis Panic? Does that sound creepy? I don't know if that's going to be creepy, but I think I have to click on it, don't I? Penis Panic. Koro is a culture-specific syndrome in which an individual has an overpowering belief that his or her genitals, e.g. penis or female nipples, are retracting and will disappear despite the lack of any true long-standing changes to the genitals. Koro is also known as shrinking penis, and it is listed in the Diagnostic and Statistic Manual of Mental Disorders. The syndrome occurs worldwide, and mass hysteria of genital shrinkage anxiety has a history in Africa, Asia, and Europe. In the United States and Europe, the syndrome is commonly known as genital retraction syndrome. The condition can be diagnosed through psychological assessment along with physical examination to rule out genuine disorders of the genitals that could be causing the retraction. That would be weird if you just kind of thought your penis was disappearing. I read about this other really weird syndrome on Wikipedia. So I'm doing this column for Lit Reactor on a bunch of... on creating your own sort of miscellany from Wikipedia, which you can get print and bound, which is pretty awesome. And there was this weird thing where you could have people would believe that there was really only one other person in their life. So, you know, rather than me having like friends and a girlfriend and a mom and whatever, I have this belief that this is one other person who is like putting on a mask and then, you know, runs out of the room, puts on a mask and comes back and it's the same person again. Like, this is like the weird, crazy belief or whatever. I mean, it's very insane. Let's see. The Cleveland Torso Murderer was an unidentified serial killer who killed and dismembered at least 12 victims in Cleveland in the 1930s. Recent research shows there may have been more than 12 murders. They were killed between 1935 and 38, but some, including lead Cleveland detective Peter Murillo, believe that there may have been 13 or more victims in the Cleveland, Pittsburgh, and Youngstown, Ohio areas between the 20s and 50s. Two strong candidates for addition to the list are unknown victim nicknamed Lady of the Lake, found on September 1934, and Robert Robertson. Robert Robertson, huh? The victims were usually drifters whose identities were never determined, although there were a few exceptions. The torso murderer always beheaded and often dismembered his victim, sometimes also cutting the torso in half. In many cases, the cause of death was the decapitation itself. Most of the male victims were castrated, and some victims showed evidence of chemical treatment being applied to their bodies. Many of the victims were found after a considerable period of time following their deaths, sometimes a year or more. This made identification nearly impossible, especially since the heads were often not found. During the time the official murders, Elliot Ness held the position of Public Safety Director of Cleveland, a position with authority over the police department and ancillary services, including the file department. While Ness had little to do with the investigation, his posthumous reputation as a leader of the Untouchables has made him an irresistible character in the modern torso murder lore. In 1939, the torso killer claimed to have killed a victim in Los Angeles, California. An investigation uncovered animal bones. Let's see. Autopsy reports. Victim 1. Found lying 30 feet from John Doe. He'd been decapitated and emasculated. His head was recovered. 2. Male body was never identified. Emasculated and decapitated. Head recovered. The skin was treated with a chemical agent that caused it to become reddish and leathery. 3. Her body had been dismembered and her head was never found. 4. The victim was decapitated while alive. His head was recovered. 5. The victim was dismembered while he was still alive. His head was recovered. This unidentified male body was only known West Side victim. 6. Only half the torso was found. Nothing remained below the hips. The head was never found or the body identified. 7. The unidentified female body was found at the same spot as the 1934 non-canonical victim named the Lady of the Lake. Head never found. 8. The only black victim. Body decapitated and missing a rib. The head was recovered. 9. Body was male, recovered, but head never found. 10. That day, only the lower leg of the victim was recovered. Almost a month later, a human thigh was discovered floating in the river to the east of the West 3rd Street Bridge. Police officers searched the bridge and found a burlap sack containing a headless torso cut in halves, another thigh, and a left foot, all belonging to the victim. The head and the rest of the body were never found. Only victim to have drugs in her system. 11. Decapitated female body. Head recovered. 12. Discovered at the same time as Jane Doe 9, male decapitated body. Head was found in a can. Victim never identified. Ooh, they have, like, masks of the dead people that they're showing on display here. That's pretty crazy. Oof. I had no idea. Torso Killer. Oh, apparently the Brian Michael Bendis comic Torso had to do with this and was planned to be made into a film by David Fincher. That would be amazing. It was canceled. In 2013, the plan was revived, and it was reported that David Lowery would direct the film. Yeah, that's not as exciting. But, hey, found something out there. Well, everybody, I think we've had our Potoween. Told some scary stories. We decided whether or not we'd eat a dead piece of a body in order to recover from a broken leg. And we had a Chuck Palahniuk reading in a church, so pretty much guaranteed punch that ticket to go to hell. Oh, also, amazingly, parked in a parking garage and headed on the way out. There's a sign in the little window of the parking garage thing that's like, on a break, go ahead and drive through. So apparently if they're on a break, you can just fucking get the fuck out of there. So there you go. Ooh, spooky! Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.